Hi, today's November 19th, 2016. This is Mobile View Podcast number 184. I'm Pato Gasso Ward, my good friend John Westfall, and today we have a very, very special guest, my old friend Kim Bridges. I've known Kim longer than, let's see, my wife, longer than John, longer than pretty much anybody except my parents, I think. We have known each other a long time. And truth be told, Kim has been my technology guru and mentor for all of that time I've known him. So it's going to be really fun to catch up with him. So before we get started, two items. Well, actually, I'll let Kim do the second one, actually. One item. One is kind of a grump that I hope is resolved soon. So I have been talking endlessly and annoyingly about the Acer Chromebook R13, which is a touchscreen device, reasonably priced, about $400, that can run the beta version of Chrome OS that allows you to run Android apps inside of Chrome OS. So I've been waiting for it. Finally became available on Amazon with free shipping, Prime free shipping. A couple of weeks ago, I kind of hemmed and hawed, and finally I got to pull the trigger. And lo and behold, it can't be shipped to Alaska or Hawaii, where I am. So I thought, well, maybe it's a battery thing. You know, you can't buy lithium-ion batteries from Amazon and ship it to Hawaii either, I think. So I tried to kind of resolve that. Then I said, well, I wonder if other Chromebooks are available. So I looked around and said, sure enough, you can ship other Chromebooks to Hawaii and Alaska, for that matter. So what's the deal? And the answer is, I don't know. But I do happen to know one of the public relations people at Acer. So I sent her an email, and she responded, said she'll look into it. So hopefully she's good for her word, and I'll get an answer why you can't get a Chromebook R13 in Hawaii or Alaska, but you can get other Chromebooks, including other Acers. Anyway, that's my rant.
Todd, I will hope that is someone just didn't check the right box when they entered the Amazon product, but I fear that it might be something more sinister than that.
Well, so. You know, some people do not know that Alaska and Hawaii are part of the United States, and they may be, you know...
How can they not? They're just right off the coast of California on most maps. I mean,
sometimes it's beneath Texas.
Yeah, exactly. They have their own little boxes and everything. It kind of highlights them. So,
but at any rate, so that's my rant and gripe. But like I said, hopefully the nice people at Acer will, if not able to tell me why I can't, well, hopefully they'll tell me why I can't buy one, and maybe even better, how to tell me how I could buy one. But in any case, so back to Kim or Kent Bridges. Everybody knows him as a Kim. So I've known him a long time. He's a retired professor of botany at the University of Hawaii. But he's one of the busiest retired people I know. It was hard to find him pinned down long enough to record a podcast with him. I think we've been trying this for a couple of years now. So, Kim, let's start with something Google-ish before we get to some old and new stuff that I've been wanting to talk about. You and John were talking earlier before we started recording about the Google Sites update, which has apparently not been surfaced in the news articles or blog or anything yet.
First, let me say hi, Todd and John. It's great to be with you guys. I've been listening to podcasts, and it's fun to be able to participate. So Google Sites, I make a lot of use of Google Sites. I've done it for a long time. It's easy to use. It just was very comfortable, but it was beginning to look old. And when I go back and look at all my Google sites, they all were mostly text, hardly any pictures. It just wasn't that comfortable putting graphics in. So I was editing one of my sites last night, and Google popped up and said, would you like to try the new Google sites? New Google sites, I say? Sure. And they've completely reworked it. It was not just a cosmetic fix, but it looks like they re-engineered it from the ground up. Mm. And it's quite remarkable. They've done two things. They've made it look good, and it's adaptable to all formats so that, and you can even preview it. How does it look on a phone, tablet, or a large screen? And that's real easy to do. So they've allowed you to integrate all of the things that Google does. You can put YouTube stuff in and easily put pictures from your collection, all that stuff. But they've also taken away a bunch of stuff. Oh. There were a number of things that we could do. You could have a little HTML sandbox. That seems to be gone. Some of the depth of organization seems to be gone, but the substitutes seem to be well worth it. Now, the question is, what do we do when we have all of their old sites? And they do say in their documentation, we'll have at least a year before the old Google sites disappears. They promise a migration tool next year, 2017. In the meantime, we get to cut and paste and do it on our own. So I'm inclined to wait a little bit. I'll build some new sites, but not all of the machinery is there. So I think people can expect to start seeing it this coming week, and it's worth playing around with. I'm not quite ready to make a full commitment to it, but it certainly looks like it'll be something I'll use heavily.
You know, if I recall correctly, Google Sites is descended from the Google Wiki that they bought from somebody.
Well, it was originally JotSpot.
There you go.
And, the lab group that I've worked with the most over the last, 10 years now has used Google Sites as their primary wiki for 10 years. And we've come up with a lot of interesting little workarounds. So, and they've made use of HTML and iframes and other things. So I'm really hoping that whatever Google is rolling out, we can kind of migrate without losing a lot of that functionality. Because I think people have used Google Sites for kind of two purposes, either a very quick external site, which, you know, my consulting website is a Google site because it's real easy to edit, the one time every three decades I edit it. But also a lot of technical stuff, you know, the wiki sites and things like that are predominantly text-based, and a couple of links here, an iframe there, using the hierarchical page system and, you know, page level permissions and things like that. So I am excited and nervous about this all at the same time.
Yeah, John, from what I've seen, I'd be a little nervous too. It may be that they're going after a different audience. And we may see this just as a completely different product.
Right. Yeah, and honestly, the last time I think they added anything to sites was around 2010. They did roll out page-level permissions for editing, which I think was the last thing they did. And so it's obviously a product that they've decided, thankfully, not to mothball and get rid of. But I'm concerned. But thankfully, there are a lot of products out there that I could probably port a wiki over to. The only issue is the last time I tried to migrate Google Sites to anything else, I couldn't find any easy migration path. And that was a huge issue. In fact, when we ended up moving Google Sites into a Google Apps installation, so originally it was just a regular Google site under a personal Google account that was shared out to other personal Google accounts, I remember spending about 6 months trying to figure out how to do that. And in the end, the solution, which I did publish on my blog, and I still get a few hits every couple of months on this, was to do a Google site copy, which is this little feature hidden deep down in the admin structure to do it. So I had to rely on Google's own integration with itself to copy whole sites over to different groups, because there's no easy export tool that I know of that can get stuff out of Google Sites.
So it's going to be interesting after using that the group you're working with, having used it for a decade now, when this transition comes sometime next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, we're already transitioning other things. Our primary dedicated server is moving on to the Amazon Web Services cloud. So we might have a lot of changes that it's time to update after 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, getting back to our guest, Kim Bridges. So we have a mix of old and new tech stories because he's seen it all. And in his lab, I always thought it was the first HP LaserJet in the state of Hawaii, but he tells me now it was a second. So, it wasn't anything special, I guess. but yeah, this is back in days when nobody essentially had LaserJets of any kind. So that was pretty exciting. I remember I saw the first LAN in his lab, or at least the first non-organizationally owned LAN. So a personal local area network was installed in his lab and a whole bunch of other stuff. But I want to start with a couple of stories from him because he's got pretty amazing stories. Let's start with your Marshall Islands and the early GPS. So what year are we talking about, your trip out to there?
Well, it was in the 2000s. We'd been approached by the mayor of Rongelap Atoll. This is right next to Bikini Atoll. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's important being next to it is the fallout from the nuclear tests went from Bikini and landed on Rongelap Atoll. And so there was no one, basically no one living there anymore because of contamination. There'd been a lot of work done to clean it up, and they were trying to reestablish the population, and that's how we were helping. But right between the two, between Rongelap and Bikini, was a small atoll that had really been impacted heavily by fallout. As a result, nobody had visited there in 50 years.
Wow.
And so it was pretty pristine. The contamination basically washes down. It's mostly cesium. It washes down into the sand. And so you can walk around and there's no real danger. You're just not going to eat anything that grows there because the cesium's down in the root zone. So we were invited to go survey. It's called Ilingani Atoll. And so we mounted an expedition and went there, and we did a big botanical and underwater survey. At the end of our period, we took a small boat back between Ilingani and Rongelap. This is 12 miles. And the Marshallese are the best ocean navigators in history. So we said, we're going in a small boat. They know how to do it. No problem. So off we go in the afternoon, and we're out in the open ocean. We're away from land. We can't see anything except ocean. The seas are getting heavy. There's squalls raining on us periodically. Occasionally, one of the two engines on the boat stops. Somebody's got to go back and pound it a bit, and they start it up again. And so we do this for a few hours, and finally my colleague says, do you have a GPS? And I said, yeah, but you know, it's up in the front of the boat in a waterproof container. If I go up there and get it, I'm going to get banged about, and I really don't want to do that. He said, no, go get it. All right. So I went up and I got it, and I came back and I turned it on, and I looked at it and said to the guy steering the boat, turn left. We're 90 degrees off course. Now, the GPSs in those days didn't have databases with maps in them. And so you had to be getting information relative to some fixed waypoint. And I just happened to have taken that same GPS to Rongelap Atoll a year before and just happened to put in a waypoint at the entrance to the lagoon, and I just happened to not delete it. And so we did the left turn, headed to the lagoon, which we finally got to see. We got right to the entrance and ran out of gas.
Wow.
Had we not done it exactly when we did it, we would still be out at sea. Nobody was expecting us. Nobody knew we were out there. Nobody would have come looking for us. And so I can actually say that GPS saved not only my life, but the other three people on the boat.
Wow. That's not something most of us run into.
I will echo again what Todd said. This is a real honor to have you on this podcast, because very nearly that would not have been possible had you not had that GPS even in a location that was easily accessible. I mean, you... getting pounded around is one thing, but it could have been, you know, with all the squalls and everything underwater or something like that in a hold somewhere. So,
yeah, exactly. There's a reason we carry technology, and sometimes it's to make us safe. As a result of that and a few other similar experiences, this colleague and I, Will McClatchy, wrote an article for our Society's journal about how can we be safer? What are the things we should do? And we started teaching people safety. And I'll just quickly add that in the botany department, in preparing for that article, we went around and asked every faculty member, do you have a story of where things turned bad during your field work? And every single faculty member had a story almost as bad as the one I just told.
Wow.
That people had fallen off cliffs. They'd gotten lost on volcanoes. There were lots of really bad things, and people just tended to not talk about it. So I always carry a small safety kit, even when I'm in an urban situation. I've got an urban safety kit, and I have a out-in-the-forest safety kit. Mm-hmm. And I recommend it. It can be small.
Well, and I kind of assume that you have the same frustration I have with technology being seen as kind of a toy by some people when it's a valuable tool that can save you. And I'm sure it would not take too much of polling of my Facebook friends to say, you know, is GPS essential technology for them to go, oh, we could just go back to maps. Maps were just fine. These kids today and their newfangled toys. And it always frustrates me when I think about stories like that, where technology is the difference between life and death. It isn't, and it's great that now it can be considered a toy, but
true.
It's still much more useful than that.
And for people who don't That's remember, right. in the early 2000s, a personal GPS was pretty rare. I think the only common one I can think of was maybe the Street Maps GPS that Microsoft used to sell, which was terrible. The one you mm-hmm. plugged in, you need a notebook. It didn't, you know, phones, of course, didn't really have GPS.
Oh, yeah. Fan.
And it was kind of maybe, you know, take maybe 10 minutes to acquire satellites to get your location. And sometimes it was off by 100 meters or more. So this is, even though it's, you know, Kim says it was only 2000 something. Back then, we're talking 15 years ago. Back then, this was mm-hmm. still new stuff. This was stuff that was not common yet.
Yeah, GPS right. was the last major feature that smartphones finally got.
Yeah.
You know, Bluetooth mm-hmm. was around 2002, 2003, Wi-Fi 2004, 2005. GPS was around 2007, 2008 before you really saw that yeah. coming into even smartphones. It and now really we kind Apple, of assume it's always there.
Yeah, I think it was really the Apple iPhone that really first got made GPS a must-have feature of your smartphone. Until then, it was kind mm-hmm. of specialized, and you had to either add it on as a accessory or, you know, it's a very mm-hmm. unusual phone for vertical markets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, continuing on to travel strategies and bringing up a little closer up to date, mm-hmm. I know you have literally been traveling around your whole life, but more recently, I know you've been adapting newer technology to your travels, and of course, a little later on, we'll talk about your smart car. And how you've been tooling, literally tooling all over North America and that thing.
Yeah, well, Todd, I'll bring up one thing that you do remember. Some years ago when Segways came out, I had been in Paris with Nancy, my significant other, and we took a tour of Paris at night in a rain on Segways. And we said, oh, this is too good to pass up. Talk about technology. So I came back and tried to figure out how I could get a Segway and eventually got one. And I said, the way you should work with technology is not just sort of have it on the side and I'll use it if I want, but you should commit yourself to it. So I gave away my car.
I remember this.
And I only had a Segway. And I rode that for about, well, I bought two of them. They came out with a newer one with a better battery. But I put about 8,000 miles on Segways. And so every day when I would go to work at the university, that's how I would get there. There was never an option. That was it. And Todd, as you know, it rains heavily in Honolulu.
Indeed it does.
And I have to tell everyone, what do you do when you're on a Segway and it's raining really hard and the streets are flooded? And the answer is you have more fun than anybody else. You get to splash in the water. You get to have cars splash you. And all you do is wear great rain gear. So my big concession was I got some of the fanciest rain gear I could and didn't mind ever going out in the rain. That I was having fun, and everybody else was miserable sitting in their cars stuck in traffic.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
And it never took me longer to get to work if it was raining or not. It was always the same length of time. So So I spent about 5 years on Segways, having the time of my life.
Yep, I remember visiting you to go see your Segway.
And that was an important event because you got a picture of me on my Segway, and that's one of the only pictures I have of me on a Segway.
Yeah, it was quite a thing. It still is. It's still unusual to see somebody in a Segway.
Right, but it was interesting because everybody on the route got to know me. Oh. I was so recognizable that every store owner practically would wave at me as I would go by.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And if I was traveling and didn't go by for a week, they'd wonder if I was okay. Even people driving by knew. And I used to get annoyed at people who would honk at me.
Yeah.
Because I thought I was doing something wrong, but they were just saying hi.
Oh. Yeah, now there's
so that was a strange technology.
Now the Segway used to be really expensive, like about 5,000 list, as I recall, maybe more.
I'm not sure. Exactly. They were about 5,000.
And I recently saw a much smaller Segway, I mean way smaller than the one you had, in Sam's Club, you know, the Center of Technology. That was about $800, I think. But it was really small, and I couldn't figure out how you actually rode on it, because it didn't look like the handlebars were up high enough, and I haven't looked up the website, but it looked a little odd.
Yeah, I think somebody in China bought the patents, and they're making all sorts of alternative designs.
I see.
I'm happy with my big one.
Oh, so you still have it?
I still have it. Okay. I don't ride it much because I'm walking for exercise, 10,000 steps a day. Which, Todd, you seem to get without any trouble.
Are you on my Fitbit? We got to be Fitbit friends if you're on your Fitbit. But
I monitor you.
Okay. I am, for the last 7 days, I am at 92,000 steps. So I'm above my 10,000 average mark. I'm beating my daughter, which is kind of amazing, but she's at like 70,000. And she went hiking, too, so I'm not sure how I'm beating her. But okay. In any case, so more on your travel stuff. I was really, before John joined us in the podcast, we were kind of just chatting before we started recording. You were talking about something called Wear One, Carry One, or whatever that is. Is that a brand, or is that just a philosophy? Or
That's a philosophy. There's a company called Icebreaker, and they're in New Zealand, and they make garments out of merino wool. And merino wool is a technology that everybody should know about, because you can wear a merino wool shirt for 3 days and it won't smell at the end of 3 days. So assuming you're not splashing around in mud and stuff, but just sort of doing urban stuff, you get to wear your clothes for 3 days. And so what we do is we wear one outfit and we take one outfit. And if you look at the 3 days, that means we can go 6 days between laundering.
Wow. Now, we're talking about like cooler, temperate climates, not like Honolulu.
Even Honolulu.
Wow.
The merino wool has a really interesting property if it just does not develop smell. And so we have this philosophy, and we traveled all over the world, including pretty long trips. Not unlike your trip to Scotland, Todd.
Mm-hmm.
And we just do the same thing. We have different weights and we can layer, but it really does work. And so we don't use roller boards or anything. We just have small backpacks and we can easily carry our clothes. We have good rain jackets. And in terms of the wear one, carry one, one of the carry ones is pants, and we use waterproof pants.
Hmm.
So one of the options is, so you have one dressy pants and then one waterproof pants. So we can go out in the rain too. We don't want the rain to slow us down.
Right.
So it's worked out to be a real good combination. The impact is, that people might be interested in, is that it's such a small kit that we get to take more electronic gear.
Mm-hmm.
That as we add tablets and stuff like that, we're not straining our weight limits. That we like to keep our packs real light, And so we can carry more gear because we're not carrying so many clothes.
And have you also switched to carry-on only, not checking in baggage?
Yeah, our carry-on only, and it's small enough that our two packs equal the size of one roller board.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the things this reminds me of is I've been carry-on only my entire life. I don't think I've ever checked a bag on an airline.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and my bags unfortunately are a lot bigger. They're the max I can get, and they're also heavier because I'm much bigger of a person than most people. And my clothes take up a lot of space. But I will say, as someone who has done carry-on only, it is about the most freedom you could ever think of when you're traveling. People who have always checked bags really do not understand the fact that the headaches that you have mostly in air travel is because you're trying to, you know, make sure the bags are checked and where are the bags and did they come in yet. When you can just walk off a plane and walk straight out to a taxi or, you know, straight into someone's car that's picking you up, it's a nice feeling. So I would encourage people to think about it if they haven't.
I completely agree. And as John knows that, you know, I only recently converted to this philosophy of not checking in baggage, having done it for many, many, many decades. And it is amazingly freeing for somebody who has been doing the check-in route for decades and decades. I know when I came back from London, it was the first time I really went on a long trip with just a carry-on. And it was a week-long trip, so it's not super long, but long enough that normally I would take a suitcase with me. But coming in through LAX, since you have to do a plane change when you land in the U.S., if I had been carrying, or if I had had a check-in luggage with me, would have had to go get it, take it back in through customs, recheck it in, and then go to my gate. But without any check-ins, all I did is I got off a plane and went through TSA and customs control, and off I went to the domestic gate. So I understand what you both are saying. It's very freeing.
Well, I think you also have to carry it beyond the airport.
Yeah.
You have to get around town. You have to get to that hotel or the place you're staying.
Absolutely.
And if you've got a suitcase, this can be a struggle. And if you get older, like most of us do, it gets harder and harder. So
if you don't get older, it actually gets a lot easier.
I just can't handle it as easily anymore. So this has been a nice discovery for us, and we've optimized it. That's pretty good.
Yeah. And, you know, as Kim might remember, in my younger days, I used to be really anal retentive about planning for trips. But as I get older, I've gotten a lot less, detail-oriented on some of my trips. And so when I went to London to, as I say, go pick up my daughter from school, she was finishing up a study abroad program there. When I went to go pick her up from school, I flew into Heathrow, not exactly knowing how I was going to get from Heathrow to my hotel. I had some ideas in mind. And because I only had a carry-on with me, I basically had a backpack and in a little case for my iPad. It was really easy. I just, you know, caught the Heathrow Express from Heathrow all the way into Paddington Station, which was like, I don't know, 3 blocks from my hotel, and I hoofed it over. It was nice.
Yeah, when I used to fly back from the West Coast when I lived in New York, I would usually take a red-eye flight, get into JFK at about, I don't know, 6 in the morning, schlep up to the subway, take the subway over to Manhattan, get down to Grand Central Terminal, get on a Metro North train to head up north. So my wife would always drive me to the airport, but then she could pick me up at the train station 2 miles away from our apartment. So it wouldn't have been possible if I had had a bunch of luggage. If I had one bag, I could do it no problem. Of course, I always tried to fall asleep about one stop before I would get off and be still. So.
So I have a whole bunch of other travel tech questions, but you have any other travel tech travel strategies involving mobile tech, Kim, before I go on to your big your big accessory, your car?
Well, I read a lot of the ultralight backpacker literature. Mm. Not that I'm going to go out and be a backpacker and hike the forests as much as I used to. But there's some good philosophy about the less you carry, the more you have to know. And I think that's a good philosophy for all of us, that as we get these tools that are multi-purpose tools, you've got to be smarter and smarter on how you use them to be effective. When we had relatively dumb tools, it didn't take much knowledge to know how to use them. The use was obvious. But as now as we get more of the multi-tools, smartphones being the prime example, the more you really have to know how to use them. So that comes out of the backpacker world. Their philosophy is that if you're really light, you can go farther, faster, and for more years. And that kind of fits the way a lot of us want to use technology. And then there's the ultimate botanist dictum, fewer clothes, more money.
That's a good life philosophy in general.
Yeah, that's any decision.
Right, so... So a lot of people take too much stuff, and both of you probably recall when you have tucked in an extra cable saying, you know, I better be redundant on these cables, or I better be redundant on that, that we build in a lot of redundancy, and that all has a lot of weight and bulk. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should just not have so much redundancy and trust that we could replace that cable if we really need to. Just take a little more money instead.
I hate to say this because my wife is in the room and she'll probably be mad at me for saying this, mm-hmm. but that's usually my mantra when we do go on trips is, you know, we're going to be going from Mississippi to Pittsburgh. There's Walmarts all along our route. So if we forget anything, we can get it when we're there and it will not be a big deal. So I think when you're going obviously into more exotic climates, then yes, you're going to not have that availability, but I do think people overpack quite a bit and they don't realize the weight of it, especially if they grew up with it. You know, we all found out that if you went without checking a bag, it was incredibly freeing. But if you were born into a family that all your trips were multi-luggage affairs and pack everything. Yeah. Well, if you're Todd, then you, you don't know about that.
That's right.
And you know,
so I think it's,
go ahead.
I think it's good reading some of this, a literature that doesn't pertain precisely, because it does give you some hints that can be carried over.
Yeah, you know, and I've mentioned this to John in past podcasts, as I was, you know, I don't like traveling, although I've done more of it than I've really liked to in the past. But this year I did, as Kim mentioned, a lot more traveling than I usually do to visit my daughter when she was in the UK. And one of the people I discovered who has become, I've never met him, but has become my travel guru is Rick Steves, who has a PBS program and so forth. And by the way, I should mention, although I've tried to pay him back in a sense by buying my backpack and day bags and travel books, digital, of course, from him. So that was my way of paying him back for all his good advice on YouTube. But in case he has advice on how to travel light and how to pack light. And one of the things is exactly what you guys are saying. He says, you know, unless you're going to the wilds of Kathmandu, you know, outside of Kathmandu in Nepal, where there's no Walmart and that sort of thing, you can usually buy toothpaste and deodorant and soap and even towels, you know. So you don't really need to carry those unless you have some kind of hypoallergenic thing you need. But it's really interesting advice that I had not thought of.
It's right on. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now moving on to your one giant accessory. I've been fascinated by your stories of this over the years. So you bought a smart car for people who'd never seen one, or you've probably seen one, you may have known what it is. It looks like a little tiny half-size Volkswagen in size. So it's smaller than an old Volkswagen Bug. And I think it is, who's the parent company of Smart? Is it BMW or Mercedes? I can never remember.
It's Mercedes.
Mercedes. Okay, so it's got a good track record in terms of, you know, car building. It's not a, you know, flash in a pan company merged out of nowhere. And you have, how long have you had your Smart car now?
I bought it in 2010. Okay. So. And people should know that I live in Hawaii. But I have never had that car in Hawaii. Yeah. I leave it on the mainland. My mom lives near San Diego, and I visit her often. And I thought, well, I'm going to be paying a lot of money for rental cars over the years. Every time I visit, I'll be paying for a rental car. Why don't I just buy an inexpensive car and leave it there? And over the years, maybe it will be a good investment. And indeed, it has. It's more than paid for itself. So I've got a smart car that was sitting for a long time in Southern California. I just recently moved it to Oregon. Now, once you have a car on the mainland and you haven't been driving a lot, what do you do with it? You decide that you'll go to meetings by flying to the West Coast, getting in your car and driving to the meeting. And so I've now taken it across the country, coast to coast, four times. Those are four round trips. And John, I was looking at where you live, and I came really close to you on one of the trips. Wish I had known I would have come by.
You never know. If you're hearing your stories, I'm pretty convinced it'll probably be a fifth round trip at some point.
Yeah. So as I began to cross the country to go to meetings, they would, of course, be in different locations. I started accumulating states that I had visited because I'd like to take different routes each time. And pretty soon I got it down to where I was only missing six states. And I thought, well, I wonder if I can hit all the states except Hawaii. And so one of the challenges was Alaska. And Todd, you as an old Alaskan,
yep,
will appreciate. So I arranged with a colleague who lives in Fairbanks that maybe we would go to the Arctic Circle together. He would be a chase car, and we would take the Smart. And after an entire year of planning and getting reservations, because what you do is drive to Bellingham, Washington, put it on a ferry, and that takes you up to Alaska. You drive through Canada and then actually get up into Alaska. And then from Fairbanks, it's still quite a distance, a few hundred miles to get you up to the Arctic Circle. And we did it. It was late in August, a couple of years ago.
Oh, so it's still warm.
Yeah. and then you get to the Arctic Circle, and then you head a little further north to spend the night in Coldfoot. And that's about 60 miles further. And so we spent the night at Coldfoot, and then the next day we drove another 15 miles north to visit some people that our friends knew. The weather was not very good. We turned around at that point and started heading south. As we got further south, this is a dirt road. It's called the Hall Road. It's one of the roads they use on these adventure series, the ice road people. Mm-hmm. And it was not designed for cars. It was designed for huge trucks. And as we get close to the end of it, it's getting very muddy and rainy. And we finally get back onto paved roads and then eventually to Fairbanks. And we get a phone call saying, glad you're back because there was a big accident on the Hall Road today. It's closed for the season.
Oh, my.
And the city that we had left at the northernmost point, that got snowed in that night.
Oh, wow.
It was the first snow of the season. And so according to our friends in Alaska, they have not opened the Hall Road to cars since then. Now, when we got some fuel next to the Yukon River, the person who was running the little tourist site there had to rush over and get our picture. They had never seen a car like ours. So we're pretty sure that we're the only Smart ever to make it on the U.S. side. They've done it on the Canadian side, but we made it to the U.S. side on the Arctic Circle. That was a great adventure. So that added Alaska kind of in spades. But then I was able to take a trip and pick up the other states so that I got all 49. And having done that and ending that up in the upper right-hand corner of the country, we decided we would do Canada. So we picked up all of the Canadian provinces on the way home, which was a real challenge because it was so early in the season that year that they hadn't fixed any potholes.
Oh.
And Smart cars do not like potholes. And so that was very hard driving for us. So we're the first one to do 49 states and all of the provinces, and the first one to the Arctic Circle, and I've done the furthest east and furthest west on the highway system. And the last thing I picked up was on the trip back from the East Coast this summer, Mount Evans, which is the highest paved road in the U.S. at about 14,200 feet.
Where is Mount Evans? I don't know where that is.
Not far from Denver.
Okay. Oh, in the Rockies. Got it. That makes sense.
Yeah, in the Rockies. Yeah. So I think we've set about as many records as we're going to.
Right.
It'll come back to Hawaii one of these days, and we'll have all 50 states. Right.
My question about the Alaska trip, did you have the lucky GPS with you?
Yeah, I didn't have that one. I had others. Believe me, I had others. I spent a lot of money. There's a group called Smart Madness in Signal Hill, California, and they worked real hard to help me equip the car. I put on special wheels with steel rims. I had tow hooks, tow ropes. I made sure I had jacks. I never carry a spare tire, but on that trip, I bought a spare wheel just in case. Extra water, batteries. I was very, very well equipped.
I would have been tempted to bring a spare car. I mean, you know, a spare smart car.
You know, in Alaska, when you travel long distances during the winter, you actually don't travel alone. You always have somebody in a chase car with you.
Oh, yeah.
If you break down when it's 30 below zero.
I'm not saying chase car would be my spare car. I'd have, you know, towing another car just in case.
Yeah, and you know, go ahead.
We had a chase car when we did the haul road, and that was important. And it was a big vehicle, a big Mercedes.
Yeah, so you know, I remember that you had a problem with speaking of GPSs and travel, or two things, I guess. One, what did you use for wireless data in Alaska? Because nobody except Verizon is up there, I think. So were you on Verizon or were you using just the raw GPS data?
In those days, I was using Verizon.
Okay.
So I was okay. And I checked in frequently with our friends who live in Alaska. So people knew where I was, and they were monitoring the progress.
Yeah. And actually, as another trivia note, Alaska is such, still, I think, such wilderness area that there are towns with no roads at all. The only way to get there is to either hoof it, sleds during the winter, or helicopter or plane. And I also think that Alaska probably has the highest proportion of physicians that are also pilots. But now, one of the problems I remember you ran into at one point with your smart car is that your phone was draining its battery.
Well, I couldn't get enough power from the car to keep the phone alive if I was running the GPS. and so I would lose my navigation. But you get the little dongle you plug into the cigarette lighter socket. And apparently it was just putting out way too little power. And that became a real concern for me. In fact, it's kind of a continuing concern because as we get these phones that can do the quick charging.
Yeah.
And I have the Nexus 6P. The old chargers don't really work. I needed new ones that were high power. And so.
You mean the portable battery, those kind of things? Yeah.
Yeah, both portable batteries and the car charger. I've had to go to the higher power one to make sure that I was getting the right one. So I have a bunch of these old little power bricks sitting around that I don't use anymore. Because they just aren't good enough to do my phone. And I think I didn't expect that. And I discovered that, I think, in Singapore when I had taken these batteries to recharge my phone and none of them worked.
Oh.
And so that was something that I wish I had anticipated.
A good thing to always remind people to test all of their tech regularly. Not make too many assumptions. I had the same thing when I think it was the iPhone 5, had a nasty overheating GPS problem. And I found that out on a trip from Louisiana up to where I was born outside of Cleveland, Ohio. And it was the first time taking that route, so I didn't really know the roads that well. Needed the GPS and had the phone overheating reliably because it was sitting on the dash in the sunlight. Right. And, mm-hmm. yeah. And then even when it wasn't overheating, when I finally put it down below, it was going through battery much quicker than it usually does. So
yeah,
some of those things, you really want backups, you want tests, you want to know that stuff far in advance.
Right. Yeah. A few notes on my car, Todd, since you brought it up. I have a hard mount for my phone that sits to the left. Just next to the steering wheel, but I also put in a really good hard mount with an arm on it so I can mount a tablet. Mm-hmm. And I'm usually driving alone on these long trips, and I love having a tablet, and that's the one I use, generally speaking, to monitor the performance of the car. I use something like Torque, so I can tell the engine's heat and stuff like that, so I can make sure I'm safe. Because a lot of times I'm going across deserts, up in high mountains, and I really want to know the car performance. And then I keep a tablet on the seat, and that's how I stream my audio books. And the way I can do these long-distance drives by myself is to listen to good stories. And I find it really keeps me awake and alert, and it makes the drive something. It takes it from being a chore to a real pleasant experience. Mm-hmm.
Like somebody telling you a story the whole way along.
Exactly. And so audiobooks has become one of my best friends. And that really has made a difference. And I'm not sure everybody has really discovered that, that audiobooks just really can change a commute.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if you, So audiobooks and podcasts and things like the great courses and things like that you can download. It's amazing how they turn time that was lost time into very productive time. Absolutely. That you can and enjoyable time.
Right.
And I just, for whatever reason, I thought after my daughter graduated high school I would have a lot more time to read and stuff, but that didn't materialize. But that's the only way I can read books, and I use the word read in quotes, I guess, where people get upset, is to listen to Audible and podcasts and things like that. That's how I consume all my reading material for years and years now. Even though I don't have a long commute, it's only 10 miles, it sometimes takes up to an hour in each direction. So having a good audio book and podcast is definitely a, if not a lifesaver, certainly a mind saver. Prevents me from going crazy when doing the annoying commutes.
And as the psychologist on the call, I will remind everyone that it is reading. It doesn't matter if you're taking in the information visually or if you're taking it in auditorily. You're still processing it. You're still, you can zone out with an audiobook just like you can when you're reading a regular book and you're just seeing the words and not actually processing it. So,
and we will call it. Moving from our sensory modality to visual, since you mentioned that. So one of the things I wanted to talk to Kim about was something he did, in the 1980s, I want to say, and something he's considering doing now in 2016, 2017, and that is years ago, he decided instead of buying something else, he bought Lumina 8. Which is, what was that something else you gave up buying, by the way?
So I had been going to a lot of graphics conferences. I was really into wondering how the field was going. And I knew the local dealer. And he called me one day and he said, I have a Lumina 8 system. I can sell it to you at cost if you decide right now you're going to buy it. And I was in the middle of a ham sandwich. I clearly can picture that ham sandwich. And I thought about it, and he told me the price, and I said, I'd been saving up for a new Porsche. And it was the same price as a new Porsche. And I said, well, what the hell? I've had two Porsches before. Let's go with the computer graphics this time. And so I spent a Porsche-sized pile of cash on computer graphics. And I got a Lumina 8 system, and it really kind of took over the lab, as you remember, Todd.
I do remember that.
There were lots of people that came in about 6 o'clock every night. The artists would wander in the lab and be there till 1, 2 in the morning. So we had kind of two shifts in the lab every night. it was great fun.
Yeah. For those who don't know what Luminate is, by the way, so this is 1980s, as I recall, Kim, maybe 88?
Yeah, late 80s.
This is back when you know, the sum total of art was either Mac Paint, for those of you who remember, which was black and white, if you recall that, or Microsoft Paint 1.0 and Windows, what would it be, Windows 2.11, something like that. We're not talking about real art at that point in most computers. Lumina 8 was a combination of high-end graphics software that could just do amazing things, even now, even today, I would say it could do does amazing things, and special graphics hardware. So it wasn't just a piece of software. You had to buy special graphics display adapter and special input to used with a high-end digitizing tablet, and you needed a very, at the time anyway, it was a high-resolution monitor, which was probably still 640 by 480, I don't remember, Kim, but at the time, it was just a super, it's what gamers would use maybe now for, with addition of a digitizing tablet, so this was a real expensive thing, and then you also used to output it to slides, and, you know, this is before PowerPoint.
We can post a link on the notes, but the Lumina 8 system was basically an IBM PC XT, a monochrome monitor, which displayed basically let you operate the PC side, a color monitor with a 512 by 480 dot resolution, and a digitizer tablet. So there's a very nice article that I was able to just pull up from InfoWorld. On it when it came out, so we can link that up with our notes.
So that was about
the thing.
Go ahead.
The thing that was remarkable was that was a 19-inch monitor, and nobody had anything big like that.
Right.
And so it was very compelling. You walk in the room, and it took your breath away a little bit.
Right.
One quick story about that, Todd. After I had been using it for a while, I got a call from the art department, and the chairman said, we'd like to come over and visit you. And this is a computer art workstation, and I'm a botanist, and I know nothing about this. And the art department descended on me, and they stood behind me and said, show us. let's see. I'm not quite sure what to do. So I did some things. And they basically had no comment. They just left.
Oh, that's weird.
And I just said, oh, well, okay. I can understand why.
Yeah.
They called me the next day and said, would you help us write a proposal to get one? We got to have one too. And indeed, they got one.
Well, it sounds like I'm trying to follow in your footsteps, Kim, because I'm the psychologist that knows way too much about technology, to the point that last year I had our campus chapter of the Association of Information Technology Professionals ask me to come and give a talk at one of their meetings. And some of the computer science professors were looking at me like, wait a minute, what did the psychologist do in his past life?
So let me take it one step further, since we're talking about these sorts of things. The guy that invented the Lumina workstation's name is John Dunn. He's kind of a hermit. Didn't like to talk to people. Go to conventions and his company would be there, but he'd be on the fringes just watching what was happening. And I was kind of curious, so I called him and said, do you mind if I come visit you? And so Nancy and I flew up to Oakland and met him. And I thought, you know, we're going to have the great art demonstration. Here's this guy that invented the art workstation. And we go into his apartment, and it was music. His head was into algorithmic music. He had written software to make music in very interesting ways, where you don't write a score, you tell it sort of design principles, and the computer figures it out. And it was the most complicated, interesting thing I had ever seen. And I came home, and he'd given me a copy of the software, and I kind of figured out a little bit how to use it, and make a long story short, I kind of mastered it and did some music on it. And it wasn't long thereafter that the drama department called me and said, would you do the music for a theater production? Which I did. And so suddenly I was a commissioned composer and I can't read a note of music. They used my music, and you know, I was in the program and everything. Mm-hmm. But it was the power of technology that there were things that if we learned a it was basically learning a language. You learn the language, it can do things for you. And it was partly because I could program, and sort of my embarrassing story on that music composition was I had forgotten that I had committed myself and there was a deadline looming, and suddenly I had very little time. We're talking about a couple of hours to do the last piece of composition, and I had no time to do it. So I wrote a program that would write a program that would do the music. So it was really a hyper program, very high level program to write the low level code. And the first time I heard the music was the final recording of it that was going to be used in the theater production. Wow. But it was sort of if you can learn some of these skills, you can carry them up several levels of the sort of food chain of how you do stuff.
Right. And before we go ahead.
I was just going to say, as an educator, one of the things that I've always tried to inspire students to do, and Kim, I assume you did this too with your students, was to see those connections and see how the skills that you think of as just essential for this assignment or essential for this class are skills that if you plan them out, you can one day find yourself as a botanist composing music for a theater production. It doesn't just happen. You have to kind of tune that sort of opportunity-seeking system that you learn about.
And
that's exactly true.
Before we move to the next part of this discussion, moving to 2016, I also seem to remember you were using DNA sequences to write music.
Right. That John Dunn came to me one day. John moved to Hawaii and spent 5 years so we could work together. And he came to me one day and said, teach me some biology. I don't know anything about DNA. And I said, okay, I'll tell you about it. And he said, oh, I think we can play it. And so it took a year. And John's a genius level programmer, and he had to write assembler and Lisp and a lot of other things in order to get all this to work. We could feed DNA sequences in, and we could get music out. And Todd, you can post a link to my website. I've got a bunch of songs that we did on DNA.
Okay.
And the story's there. But it is not four notes. It's much more complicated than that. And the story's posted on my site. So.
Okay, I'll get your URL from you later. I did want to move to the next. So moving from 1980s, late 80s to now. So the next thing you're interested in, apparently, is the Surface Studio that was announced, but I think not quite yet available. So what are you going to do with that?
Well, first of all, I have the Surface Pro, but unlike other people, I've got version 1. So mine's a little bit long in tooth, but it served me well. I do a lot of what I call computational photography. I take pictures, a lot of pictures, but I use multiple images in lots of ways. For example, I do lots of panoramas, so I've got to do a lot of stitching. I do focus stacking, so I've got to do stitching. I'm getting into light painting, which involves stitching multiple levels. So much of my photography involves multiple photos to make one image. HDR is another example. And so I'm doing a lot of work with high-resolution pictures, and I want that big surface. I like to get my hands on things quite literally. I like to touch the screen. And I think that this is going to be pretty interesting. I was strongly considering getting the large Wacom tablet as an alternative. But when you consider buying a new computer and that tablet, it's about the same amount as a high-end Surface Studio. So I kind of like the aesthetic of it. It'll clean up my desk a bit. And I think it's going to be pretty interesting.
And, you know, some people might think this is trivial, but one of the things I've learned recently is the most important thing about the Surface Studio is that it can tilt. Because anybody who's used a Surface table or one of those, you know, tabletop computer screens learns is that if you've got a light in the wrong place, you are going to have a bad time looking at that screen with if you can't tilt it. And so the ability to tilt the Surface Studio is probably its most important feature for a large format display with touch capabilities, I think. So I'm looking forward to hear what you have to say about it when you get it.
Technology that's as old as a drafting table. That's
right.
Yeah.
And I have a desk that is motorized that goes up and down, and I think the combination of the two will be dynamite. So anyhow, it's another experiment. Not all these experiments work out, as both of you know. Yeah. We occasionally buy something that doesn't work and that sits on the shelf.
That's how I described my novel I wrote last November during National Novel Write Month as a big giant pile of steaming novel, because it was completely horrible. But, you know, it was the experience, the crazy idea. Can you write a chapter a day and post it to your blog in real time, and the novel unfolds over 30 days, which is possible, but I don't recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, I think the only person who can pull that off is Stephen King. I think he writes that incredible speed.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Okay.
And he writes something that someone would want to read. I haven't even wanted to read my own work, so that's why it hasn't been edited since, you know, last November.
Okay, as we start cleaning up this podcast then... you have a tech story of the day, John?
Yeah, I was looking around for some interesting stuff to talk about, and I realized, thanks to a few sites I look at to tell you about these things, that it was 9 years ago on this day in 2007, that is 9 years from right now, that the Kindle was debuted. Amazon released the Kindle, sold out of them in 5 hours. So the Kindle being kind of the first mass used e-ink device. It wasn't the first e-ink device, but it was the one that kind of kicked everything off. And so it was also 9 years ago today that Nintendo released the Wii, but who cares about that?
Right.
We're interested in probably the e-book stuff. I'm curious for both Kim and Todd, what do you use for e-books now? And do you use a lot of e-books? Do you not use e-books? What do you like to use them on?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead, Kim?
Well, as perspective on this, I have a Pixel C. Google's Pixel C is my tablet, and I carry a keyboard when I travel. But I do a lot of reading on a tablet. I've scanned my entire academic library. Todd knows how big that was.
Included a bandsaw,
floor to ceiling, wall to wall library. And so over a period of 5 years, I scanned the whole thing. So when I moved from my office back to my apartment, I didn't bring anything with me except digital data. By then, it was all in the cloud. And I did OCR on the whole thing, so I have word-level searching for an entire academic library.
Right. And I should note, I kind of blurted it out while Kim was speaking, but Kim had a bandsaw in his lab. And to the chagrin of librarians who visited him, I think, he was bandsawing his book so he could scan all the pages.
Yeah. Because we didn't intend to keep the paper. So might as well do it easy. So I wasn't flipping pages. I was loading stacks of paper into the scanner. And huge stacks. So I really am happy reading online and being able to find the things that I need. Being able to organize stuff. And the fact that Google lets us put everything into huge piles and it'll search for us. That was something we just didn't anticipate.
Yeah. And as for me, well, as I mentioned earlier, all of my fiction and nonfiction, well, most of my fiction and nonfiction is all audio from Audible, I should mention. So, you know, I read very little in terms of printed text, but when I do, it's usually programming books because that just doesn't work on as an audio book, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I usually use an iPad mini.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm kind of on the same boat. I use an iPad mini for most of my pleasure reading and things like that. I do have a full-size iPad that I use for academic journals and things like that where I just want more screen real estate. I do have a Kindle, a newer generation Kindle. I have two Kindles in my collection of tech. One is the original Kindle from 2007, and one is the Kindle that just came out this last year, which I'm blanking on the name on, but I talked about it a few podcasts ago. And really, the only time I use that is for novels that I'm reading on vacation, where I'm going to be literally sitting out at a beach and I want an e-ink display. It doesn't get used that much, but it is very nice when I am using it, and I loan it to friends when they go on vacation, things like that. Yeah. So, but most of my ebook and my ebook collection, all that sits on my home server and usually some platform independent sort of format, either PDF or Mobi or something like that, so I can get to it and put it on whatever device I need it on.
And you know, the Kindle is really an amazing change in the way we handle printed text, because there had been a couple of ebook attempts up until then. I mean, John, you probably remember trying it on the Pocket PC, and Microsoft was had a partnership with Barnes and Noble, which no longer exists, I think. And so I think I have books I can no longer read. But in any case, but the Kindle was the first one that really worked. And the surprising thing was the first Kindle was really expensive, wasn't it? Like $200 or $300. For just
It might have been even more than that. And I remember my mother had watched Oprah, had it on kind of right when it came out and made a big kind of push with it. And my mom watched that episode and thought it was so cool, she bought one for me without me even saying I wanted it. And I was quite happy about that, because I did use that up until a few years ago. I was still pulling out the original Kindle from time to time.
Yeah, but you know, it's amazing. It's amazing that it's still a viable product to me, because you know, with all the iPads and Android tablets and so forth, you think, well, why would you need a dedicated e-reader? And yet my wife still uses a Kindle. She has an iPad, a regular size iPad, but she also has a Paperwhite Kindle that she reads novels on. So
it's a viable product. For novels, it really, there's an immersive quality that the Kindle has better than some of the other e-readers for novels. Now, technical things, you know, programming books, things like that, those go on the iPad. No contest.
You know, as much as I admire Kernighan and Ritchie's original programming in C book, I don't think it'd make a big hit as Audible.
I'd like to add that I'm actually reading more these days, because as I'm reading something, maybe a news item, I hear about a book that sounds interesting and I can have it on my reader in 3 minutes.
Isn't that scary?
Yeah.
And I read it right then. And that was when I really wanted to read it. And so almost everything that I read these days, it's not something that I have on a long list that I should one day get to, but it's something I just discovered. And now's the time to know that information. So it's being delivered just in time. And that's a whole new thing. Think about what we had to do with paper books.
Oh, yeah.
Get to the bookstore, order the book, wait for it to come in. And eventually you say, well, why did I buy this?
Well, it was even worse than that, because we didn't know what book to buy. You know, it's like, what book do I need? I don't know the universe of books on this topic. I remember belonging to a science and technology book club thing just to see their catalog and order books that would take months to arrive. And I was never sure if the book was any good when I got it, because, you know, there's like no real reviews. There's just a description page count.
Right. Yeah, for people, I think all three of us are included in this group, who used to love going to bookstores.
Yeah.
You know, it really is paradise now to have that. And I think about most of my reading is in more short form these days. I still am an avid user of RSS news feeds, and I go through about 100 to 200 news items a day, and then I save things to Pocket, that service, and I use that. And I get the little email every year that says, oh, you're within the top, you know, 0.1% of Pocket users. And it's true. If I didn't have an ability to save it right then, so that night or the next night I could go back and review it, I would miss a lot of the content that I've really grown to love having in my life over the last few years.
Heading into the last item on our list, which I see you put on a little while ago, John. Apparently, you were impressed by by one of Kim's stories.
Yes, I was realizing when we were talking about Segways that I usually am too heavy for a Segway, but if I could buy a Segway, I would probably have made use of it this week. This is how you know that you are working too hard in life. I went out Wednesday night to get in my car and drive kind of across the little town that I live in, and I stood where my car is usually parked and thought, where the hell is my car?
Oh, no.
And I had to think about it. And then I realized that on Tuesday morning, I had driven it up to campus. I had parked it. I'd gone and taught my classes. My wife also works in the same building that I work in. So around 4:30, she actually has a job that ends at 5. So at 4:30, I'm thinking, okay, I got to finish up. I got to get in the car, go home with her. So I went home with her Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, came up with her to work, Wednesday evening, went home. And so for about 36 hours, my car was not where I thought it was. It was sitting in the parking lot. So I made my 20, 25-minute walk up to campus and got my car. But this is why I'm really glad Thanksgiving is this week coming up, and so I have a little bit of time to break away. But if I had a Segway, I probably wouldn't have lost it because I would have just taken it up to my office and left it there, and I would have had a visual reminder of where it was.
Ah, that's what I came on today.
Yeah, that's how I got it.
Alrighty.
Your car story of the week.
Okay, so I'm going to bring podcast number, 184 to an end. My thanks to the good Dr. Bridges and also, as always, the good Dr. Westfall. Thanks for participating. Hope to get Kim on later because I've known him for, gosh, how long have I known you, Kim? For nearly 40 years now? No, not that long. I'm not that old. I'm pretty close to 40, though.
That's true, Todd.
and I know a lot of stories I'd like to relate and then bring them up to date. You know, what are you doing now? What are you doing differently from what we did, you know, when the first PC came out or when the first laser printer came out or first of almost anything? I mean, we saw a lot of stuff come out together. So lots of fun stories. In any case, thanks again, and we will talk to you next time.